tonight on Arena. Duke Special perform live from the Juliet Letters and Angela Burke on Maeve Brennan's The Rose Garden. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. In 1989, Elvis Costello was filming in the BBC in London. Nearby, the Brodsky Quartet were performing the works of Shostakovich at the Queen Elizabeth Hall over a number of nights. Costello went along to one of their concerts. In fact, he went back for the following two as well, so moved was he by their performance. As it happened, members of the quartet had been attending Costello's London gigs, and the mutual appreciation led to a collaboration called the Juliet Letters. On Sunday night, Duke Special, along with the Fuse Ensemble, will perform the Juliet Letters song cycle at the Sugar Club in Dublin. And I'm delighted to be joined by Duke Special, Peter Wilson, to tell us all about it. Peter, you're so welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, the Juliet Letters, as I said, was, you know, began to come alive in 1989 when Elvis Costello met the Brodsky Quartet, mm-hmm. but it was released then in 1993. And it has been recorded and performed by other acts. But what brought you to it?
Well, I was basically asked if I would be interested in collaborating with the Fuse Ensemble. And that's headed up by Joanne Quigley, who used to play for the RTE Concert Orchestra, which is where I had met her many years ago when I was recording an album of my own work with the RTE Concert Orchestra. And so it would kind of collaborated with lots of other people. But so it was a project that she'd had a desire to do for quite a while. And unbeknownst to me, she had kind of earmarked me as someone that she was going to ask. So it's an album that I was aware of, but didn't know intimately. But I really love throwing myself down the rabbit hole of projects like this where it's challenging. I have to really get to grips with the material and make my own. And I've absolutely loved it.
Now, it's based on this idea of the Juliet Letters. Tell us what that initial idea was of these people who wrote to this person, thinking it was Juliet of Romeo and Juliet.
That's right. So Elvis Costello saw a newspaper article which talked about an academic from Verona, a professor who had started, people had been writing letters to Juliet Capulet. And I don't know how this professor got the hold of them or what was in the letters. And Elvis Costello and the Brodskys didn't know this either. But Elvis was really taken by the idea that this professor was replying to these people who had written. I don't know, as Juliet or as this third party, perhaps. We don't know. But that was percolating in the back of his mind anyway. So when he met the Brodskys and they were considering what to collaborate on, this idea came up for that. And so initially it was these imaginary letters the actual letters, what could this professor have written? But it expanded and widened to, what other kind of letters are there? And just they were kind of taken by this idea of correspondence and all kinds of letters. It could be legal nature or a personal nature or an angry between family members and all kinds of things. And that was the kind of starting point for the album.
Now, we're delighted to have you performing this evening. But before that, let's play some of the tracks from the Brodsky Quartet and Elvis Costello.
Sure.
And it is quite a feat of singing, isn't it? I mean, the Brodsky Quartet don't make things easy for the singer.
That's right. And they were all involved in composing the songs. So not just Elvis Costello, but various members of the quartet were contributing lyrics and melody as well. So they're not your typical kind of pop songs.
So let's play a section of one of them. You might introduce it. I Almost Had a Weakness. So what's it? This is one of the more tongue-in-cheek, more fun ones, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the opening lines are, thank you for the flowers, I threw them on the fire. And I burned the photographs that you'd enclosed. God, they were ugly children. So, yeah, just this really kind of scathing retort from we suspect, like, some family member to their familial relation that they're corresponding with.
Okay, let's listen to I Almost Had a Weakness. That's I Almost Had a Weakness from the Juliet Letters, and that's Elvis Costello, obviously, and the Brodsky Quartet. And I'm here with Duke Special Peter Wilson, who will be performing these. Is this a daunting thing vocally for you, Peter? I know you've performed with orchestras before. It's not that, but that vocal range being demanded there of Elvis seems quite demanding to me.
Yeah, and every single song has little twists and turns that are not your kind of typical thing. And, you know, they're different to maybe songs that I've written. But that's what I love about it. You have to kind of explore the songs and find your way with it. So it involved many car trips, me singing along at the top of my voice. A few times stopped at traffic lights, and then I would look around and see the people looking over at me because I'm absolutely going for it. But yeah, I find that a really great way of learning songs is when driving.
Yes, and fun to watch, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know about that.
And then that one we just heard, I Almost Had a Weakness. That's kind of fun. It's a little bit bold, you know, a bit digging at the person they're writing a letter to. But there's all kinds of deep and difficult topics explored in the Juliet Letters.
That's right. Things like infidelity, things like trying to sort out legal costs. There are even letters from beyond the grave. So, it kind of covers a lot of the big things in life, to be honest. Each song feels like a little vignette of a character. That you have to kind of inhabit for each song.
Right, so that's what you find, that you have to create your own characters to sing each song.
Yeah, and in some ways, like, it's weird to be here on the radio talking about someone doing someone else's work when I'm a songwriter, but it's just such a wonderful collection of songs that, like, I've no interest in recording these songs because that's been done so amazingly already. So, but many people will not have had the opportunity to hear this live, and there is something really incredible and visceral and moving about hearing this collection of songs performed live. So that's why I'm delighted to be part of it.
Now, another one which is kind of fun and what we often associate the mail with, unfortunately, or the post with, is getting junk mail.
Yeah.
And that's this one. This offer is unrepeatable.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite a quick delivered lyric that was quite a tongue twister to get my head around. For this one, I imagine myself as one of these salesmen with, multiple watches sewed into their
inner
lining of their coat, and just looking to get a quick sale, you know.
Let's listen to that. This offer is unrepeatable.
Don't send any money. The fate has no price. Ignore at your peril his splendid advice. An invaluable link and an infinite chain. An offer like this will just not come again. Wish you had women to charm and bewitch. Power of life and death over the rich. Young girls will be swooning because you're exciting them. Not only fall at your feet, but be biting them. Guaranteed, guaranteed to capture your breath, or possibly scare you to death. Sign it and seal it and send it to friends. Don't mention my name, don't make any long-term plans. 36 hours, your fortunes will change. Best friends won't know you, and neither will strangers. Do not keep this letter, it must leave your hand. You have been selected from over 5,000. Twister and Jupiter, bamboozle and hoodwink you. I can't say more, it would only confuse you. The wine they will offer will go to your head. You'll start seeing double in fishes and bread. Guaranteed for a lifetime or more. Guaranteed for this world and the next. Guaranteed, guaranteed for the world and its mother. Cherish this life as you won't get another one. Unless you should take up this fabulous offer, don't leave it too late or you'll be bound to suffer. We'll be tied anyone, so we'll be gone. You won't know you're born or about to pass on.
This offer is unrepeatable from Elvis Costello and the Brodsky Quartet and the Juliet Letters. And I'm here with Peter Wilson, Duke Special. You, I think, saw a lot of, not similarities, but echoes of Lennon and McCartney and John Lennon, particularly in some of the songs.
Yeah, well, I hear a little bit of John Lennon, definitely Paul McCartney. I hear Cole Porter, Noel Coward. Joanne and the Quartet, they could really hear Shostakovich in the work. So it's a real mixture. So that's what I love about it as well. If you're finding all these little reference points, you know, even from myself when I'm singing it. So, and I think that like anyone who listens to will have their own reference points and things that they hear echoes of, depending what they've listened to. But yeah, it's a proper smorgasbord of influences.
What we've been playing so far is quite fun.
Yeah.
But that would be to maybe tweak things in the right, you know, it's not all fun. And in fact, it quite goes down deep and dark.
Yeah. Like for people coming to the show, we made a conscious decision that we weren't going to have introductions to the songs. And that we would perform the entirety without taking an interval. We are having we're our own support. So the first short half will be some songs that we've decided upon that are...
Oh, you're literally your own support.
Yes.
Act. Yes,
yeah,
yes. Yeah, yeah. So you're performing and then the Fuse are performing.
We're both kind of overlapping and doing things that are kind of related to the theme. And then an interval, and then we're performing the entirety of the Juliet Letters, because there's something incredible about this journey that you're brought on, and as you say, the two pieces that we've heard so far are quite jaunty and fun, but yeah, there's a whole breadth of
emotions. Yes, because we're going to play another track before we hear from you, mm-hmm. Peter, and this is called Why, and that would be in the darker register, I think.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, really. It's a collapse of a relationship, but it's told through the eyes of the child who's involved. So yeah, really, really moving.
Why is Daddy not here? Are you crying? Why does he still love me? you love each other. Mama's gone missing, Dad is on fire, Dad is on fire, Dad is on fire.
The musical, the music, how it corresponds to the emotion, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
You have, this isn't your debut on at the Sugar Club on Sunday. You've performed this in Bangor, in Belfast and Dundalk. How have audiences reacted to it?
Yeah, so I don't know if most of the people would know, have known the records intimately. The good thing, like my own shows, people are pretty open-minded about what kind of, I've recorded so many different records based on so many different kind of subjects, and you know it's always going to be something different. So I think people have come with that expectation that okay, we're going to trust that this is going to be of interest.
Of course, yeah.
But there's something. I think it's more like a theater experience where you don't go to the theater knowing all the lines, you know, from a play. So it's that kind of feel where, like, just the experience of hearing a quartet. I'm almost irrelevant to the whole thing. I'm like the vehicle for communicating the lyrics, but it's not like I'm leaping about the stage or anything. It's this.
Yes, but you're not behind the piano like you
I'm
are
not behind
now.
The piano,
you're out front.
I am out front, but it's more the just a way of communicating the songs, you know.
Now you are going to communicate the song yourself. Now you're going to do one of the tracks, and this is "The Birds Will Still Be Singing." Do you want to say something in introduction?
Yeah. So this is a letter written from beyond the grave, back to the person's loved one, and I think it's such a beautiful song.
Summertime withers as the sun descends. He wants to kiss you, will you condescend? Before you wake and find a chill within your bones, under a fine canopy of lover's dust and humorous bones, banish all dismay, extinguish every sorrow. Eternity stinks, my darling, that's no joke. Don't waste your precious time pretending you're heartbroken. There will be tears and candles, pretty words to say. Spare me the lily, white lily with its awful perfume of decay. Banish all dismay, extinguish every sorrow. If I'm lost or I'm forgiven, the birds will still be singing. Thank you. to tear myself away, even when you know it's over. It's too much to say. Dismay, extinguish every sorrow. If I'm lost or I'm forgiven, the birds will still be singing.
The Birds Will Still Be Singing. They are performed by Duke Special. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Duke Special and the Fuse Ensemble perform the Juliet Letters at the Dublin Sugar Club this Sunday, the 8th of December at 7 o'clock. Tickets and information at thesugarclub.com. For over three decades, Maeve Brennan wrote exquisite short stories and columns for The New Yorker. Yet by her death in New York in 1993, she was largely forgotten. When Angela Burke's biography, Maeve Brennan, Homesick at The New Yorker, came out 20 years ago, it began a revival of interest in the writer's work, one that the Stinging Fly Press has consolidated by publishing a book of her short stories, The Springs of Affection, and a book of New Yorker columns, The Long-Winded Lady. Now they publish a second short story collection, The Rose Garden, with an introduction by Angela Burke herself, who I'm delighted to say joins me now in studio. Angela, you're so welcome.
Thank you, Kay.
Now, you were living in Cherryfield Avenue in Ranelagh. That's where Maeve grew up. So is that how you became interested in her work, or was she always a kind of presence in your reading life?
She wasn't a presence in my reading life at all until Fintan O'Toole wrote a piece about her I think around Christmas 1997 maybe, and I didn't know that she had lived in Cherryfield Avenue because I didn't have the book, but friends of mine in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because I lived there for a while, had seen a review of The Springs of Affection, and they recognised the area. Now, I thought when they emailed me and said, you know, this is your house, or this is you know, a book you have to read, I thought they just meant the ordinary Ranelagh house, the kind of house I grew up in Terre an Uir, the, you know, where there's a front door that leads into a hall with two rooms off to the left and a kitchen down below. But it turned out it was when I was talking to Eta Daly, actually, the writer who taught me English for my leaving cert. But she said, did you know that she lived on Cherryfield Avenue? Because, of course, she and her husband, David Marcus, had met Maeve when Maeve was in Dublin way back and staying with her cousin, who was Roddy Doyle's mother. That was over in Kilbarrack. So there were wheels within wheels. And, of course, my field, I mean, I'm an academic in the Irish language, but I had lived in America and I loved these stories when I finally got around to reading them. I was sent a present of them by my friends in Cambridge. I really loved the stories. I really loved the writing. I met Nuala Fuelein as well around that time, and I asked her if she'd heard of Maeve Brennan, and she produced from her bag a copy of The Visitor, which was just being published. It had just been discovered.
And that was
discovered.
A novel.
It's a novella. It's a beautiful, tiny book. And Maeve had written it when she was in her 20s, before she went to work for The New Yorker. This would have been in the 1940s. And it had, you know, she must have sent it to that man, Sheed, a Catholic writer who had lots of contacts in publishing, Frank Sheed. And so Chris Cardiff, who is the American fiction editor who brought Maeve's books back into circulation and really rearranged the stories in the form we have them in now, he went on a trawl. I don't think he actually went to the Library of Notre Dame in Indiana. I think it was all done online and on the phone back in the 1990s. But he came across this typescript of this beautiful novella set in Dublin with a heroine who is quite like Maeve, but the novella has her coming back from France where her mother has died and her grandmother presides over a big house and a kind housekeeper. But the grandmother is one of these implacable, cruel women that Maeve draws so perfectly in her writing.
And we have many in the Rose Garden. But Maeve was very well connected because her father and mother had been involved in the revolutionary period here in Ireland. So that when Ireland became independent, the father was sent to America as a diplomat.
Yeah, not immediately on independence, because he was a De Valera acolyte. He was loyal, in today's terms, to De Valera through thick and thin. So actually, they were quite impoverished. Well, they weren't, you know, homeless or anything, but they lived quite a frugal life on Cherryfield Avenue in the 1920s. And then Fianna Fáil came to power. And Bob Brennan was, first of all, the manager of the Irish Press when that was set up, of course, by De Valera, for De Valera, essentially. And then shortly afterwards, 1934, De Valera chose Bob Brennan to become the secretary to the Irish legation in Washington, D.C. Ireland was still a free state, so we didn't have an ambassador. So there was this was through the Court of St. James by grace and favour of London.
And so, therefore, that's how Maeve came to America and subsequently, you know, was a writer and then began to work for The New Yorker.
Yeah, she was a writer all her life. I think she was a reader and a writer as a child. She attended Scolvrida in Dublin, Louise Gavan Duffy's Irish-speaking school for a few years. And she acted on the Abbey stage as a schoolgirl. So she was always of a literary mind, more than any of her siblings. And so when she went to Washington, she had finished her Leaving Cert in Ireland, and she went to one of these two-year colleges first, a Catholic one, and then she went to Catholic University. And she was aiming for a librarianship because she imagined she'd be coming back to Ireland. But of course, the war broke out and her father had to stay in Washington. There were submarines in the Atlantic. So Maeve then managed to get away. She was being lined up to pass canapes for many, many years at diplomatic parties, because her father was promoted from being secretary of the legation to being actually the Irish minister. In other words, he was the Irish ambassador. And so when the World's Fair came to New York, and there was the shamrock-shaped building for the Irish Pavilion, Bob Brennan was right in there, front and centre, and Maeve met everybody.
Right. And then how did she become a writer, a staff writer for The New Yorker?
Well, I think her first job in New York after, a brief stint in the New York Public Library, but one of the people she got to know was Carmel Snow. And Carmel Snow is a very interesting character. She was the editor of Harper's Bazaar, but she was born in Dublin. And her father had been working with Lady Aberdeen, finding colleens for the World's Fair in 1893 in Chicago. And he got pneumonia and died as he travelled around Ireland looking for colleens to sit outside papier-mâché cottages and spin. But his wife, his widow, headed off to New York and then to Chicago to do that work. And her daughter was Carmel Snow. And Carmel Snow grew up, well, she was left with her grandparents in Dublin, but she became a fashion writer and became editor of Harper's Bazaar. So with her Irish background, she took Maeve on.
Oh, right. And Maeve started as a fashion writer,
she did,
didn't
in
she?
Harper's Bazaar. And her first story was published in Harper's Bazaar. But then by 1949, William Shawn at The New Yorker had put his eye on her because she was a real writer. Well, Harper's Bazaar had real writers as well, but she went to The New Yorker in 1949.
And then in The Springs of Affection, which is the collection that the Stinging Fly published originally of her work, that they were the Ranelagh stories. Mm-hmm. And that was her looking back on her life and being inspired by her young life, because she left when she was 17.
That's right.
So then these the Rose Garden stories that has now come out, these are her when she's living in America, and she not only her New York life, but also her life outside of New York. Yeah. Explain this place that she wrote so much about in the early stories in the Rose Garden.
Well, all of the stories were written in America, and all but one of them were published in the New Yorker while she was a staff writer there. The Springs of Affection is the collection that Chris Cardiff put together. So he assembled the various stories that were set in Cherryfield Avenue and in Ranelagh, where there was a plaque unveiled earlier this year. He assembled those stories and he called the collection the Springs of Affection Stories of Dublin. Then he came along, having discovered before he discovered, around about the time he discovered the novella, he put the other stories together, but he did it so carefully. So almost all of these stories are set in America. There's just a little bundle in the middle of the book, including the title story, The Rose Garden, that have an Irish setting. And these are very explosive stories, and they're key really to all of the rest of her work. So in front of those stories in the book, the first seven stories of the book are set in the Hudson Valley, in a very exclusive community where a road winds through the woods and one house can't be seen from another. But of course, it's really a kind of a luxury housing estate for people who go to some kind of work, maybe just managing their money in New York. But they have a view of the river. It's called Palisades now. It was known as Sneeden's Landing, and she lived there in the 1950s when she was briefly married to a colleague at the New Yorker. But there are seven stories. And
they're
are,
wonderful, bitchy stories.
Oh, they're magnificent. They're
Irish maids, aren't they? Who hate the people they work for, really, and they just meet and they gossip about them.
That's right. And the people that they work for hate them as well. The people
That's
that
so
they
true.
Work for are full of pretension. They're full of jealousy. They, of course, and again, for an Irish observer who grew up in, you know, the Free State and then in independent Ireland, this is very exotic. All these divorced people and their little bitcheries and their ways of scoring points off each other and the multiple domiciles that allow people to continue having affairs and marrying the people they last thought of. But when these stories were first published, I think they were just seen as just a send-up of that whole world. But the Irish maids are what hold it all together, because and there's an Irish maid working in every one of these houses.
Yes. Let's talk about one or two of them. The view from the kitchen is the first one. And this is Bridie, one maid, and she is being helped out by another maid. And then she decides to gossip about what's going on in the house.
And that's a story about a woman who is married. She again, the story suggests that she married the rather hapless chap she's married to now because she wanted to demolish his cottage, his house, which was getting in the way of her view of the river. So Leona Harkey is married to a man called George, and George does something, but he's a credit manager in a department store, which again is a sort of a women's in joke, if you like, because obviously a lot of the readers of the New Yorker were buying all their clothes at the big department stores on their husband's credit cards because they wouldn't have had their own credit cards. So a credit manager is a kind of a figure of fun, a figure of derision, and also somebody that people are a bit, you know, they hate him. So Leona Harkey is a rather dull woman. She's a little bit like Arun in Molly Keane's Good Behaviour. You know, she's a little bit too big for her clothes and she's a little bit too unaware of her own body or her own place in the world or in space. So there's big send-ups of her, and then she has a small, witty male friend who lives in a tiny room in New York. He's in some of the other stories as well. And he's a critic. And again, there's a great send-up of all these figures of fashionable New York life. And it's all through the eyes and through the vernacular Irish speech of the maids.
Yes, and they do have this wildlife, the Americans in the in let's say the divine fireplace. It's reminiscent of Gatsby in the sense that all these people get together, the two families and two women, and they're vying for the man's attention, and then they end up pulling down the kitchen, really, to try and see if he has changed the kitchen. It's just bizarre stuff, but it's great fun.
Oh, it's hilarious. It's wonderful. And it's the rivalry between the women. The husband arrives home for the weekend. Well, he arrives home, it's a Saturday evening, but with a young woman in a cocktail dress in tow. And meanwhile,
what could he have been thinking?
And meanwhile, his wife, who's his second wife, recently moved into the house, who has recently refurbished it, has invited another woman who is probably another of her husband's former lovers, who is recently divorced. So there is all this condescension, all this, oh, the poor darling, we'll have to cheer her up. And then very scathing accounts of people's clothes. And of course, Maeve was trained as a fashion writer by Carmel Snow, who in turn was trained by her mother. She and her sister were taken to the Paris collections, and one of them had to remember the top of a dress and the other had to remember the skirt. Again, remember the stitching, the pleating, the darts, the embellishments. So Maeve is a pro writing that kind of stuff, but she's using it as a wonderful satirical tool to unmask these people.
Now, as you say, they're the beginning, they're the stories at the beginning of the collection. And then there are other stories which are set in Ireland. And The Holy Terror is a great story. And is that her first story?
It's the first published story. Now, I think she probably had written The Visitor, the novella before that, which is astonishing, because these stories, you know, they were read piecemeal, because the New Yorker is a weekly magazine and it lies around for a long time, and when they're brought together, you really see what she's at.
The Holy Terror
the
is
Holy
this
Terror,
woman who
it, yeah, it's
works as a hat check woman, really.
Well, yeah. Well, she's the ladies' room attendant in a Dublin hotel, which I read as the Gresham. And this story was published in 1950. And there is correspondence that shows that even though the Brennans went to Washington in 1934, parents came back in 1947, Maeve seems to have made a visit to Dublin. She wouldn't have been back from the time she was 17 until she's well into her late 20s and early 30s. So I think she's looking at this woman in the ladies' room in the hotel through the eyes of a sophisticated American tourist. But of course, she looks like an American tourist, but she's not. She grew up in this city and she knows about this woman. And this woman gathers her tips and keeps them ferociously, never spends anything, and stores up, again, material on the staff in the hotel and on the visitors to the hotel. So she knows things about people and she uses this as her insurance policy, the weapons of the week.
Yeah, well, it's a great collection. It'd be a great Christmas present, actually. I could see, well, I know I would enjoy it myself, sitting and reading all these little gossipy stories, and there are wonderful depth and great insight in them.
And they repay reading more than once.
Indeed they do. Angela Burke, thank you so much.
Thank
the
you.
Rose Garden by Maeve Brennan is published by the Stinging Fly Press. Just the name Humphrey Bogart evokes a golden era of Hollywood film noir, pristine fedoras, billowing cigarette smoke and razor-sharp dialogue. When the actor died at the comparatively young age of 57, he was already a cinema legend with roles in classics like The Maltese Falcon, Casablanca and, of course, The Big Sleep, which he made with his wife, Lauren Bacall. The pair were the definition of Hollywood glamour, a true love match with an unrivalled on-screen chemistry. A new
biography released this week by Irish filmmaker Catherine Ferguson charts the life of Humphrey Bogart, from his not-so-humble origins in well-to-do Manhattan to his glory days as a megastar of the 1940s and 50s. Paul Whittington has been watching Bogart. Life comes in flashes, and he joins me now to talk about the film and the man. Maybe we should just play a bit of Bogart from Casablanca before we start.
You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then. It all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong.
But, Richard, no one...
Now, you've got to listen to me. You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid, Major Strauss, I would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now, now. He's looking at you, kid.
You just never tire of it, do you, Paul?
You don't.
No, absolutely not. So he died in 57. That's 67 years ago. But you can just feel it there. The mystique, it just endures. Yeah. Why is that, do you think?
It's a funny one, because actually he, they don't show old films and television so much anymore, so younger people might not be so aware of who he is. But I think the only other person who's... aura has remained intact for all these years is Cary Grant. Like, they're just two people for very different reasons whose aura hasn't faded. He was a very untypical film star. He was, people used to call him Ugly Handsome, which is a bit cruel really, but he wasn't traditionally handsome. You could hear in that clip he had a scar on his upper lip, so he had a slight lisp when he spoke. He wasn't very tall. And in fact, he was 40 by the time, that was just after he'd made it, he was 40 by the time he became successful. He had laboured for years as a stooge on Broadway. He said he made more bad films in his life than anybody else because of Jack Warner, because for about 3 years there he was in every potboiler going the roads. But suddenly he got a break and he showed what he could do. And he had this very odd combination of toughness and tenderness, which I think people found very interesting.
But the thing people may not know about Humphrey Bogart is his background was quite posh.
Yeah, well, his mother, Maud, who he always said she was never mother, always Maud. She was a bit of a cold fish, apparently, but she traced her lineage back to the Mayflower. So he was quite posh and he grew up in Manhattan. His dad was a surgeon and his mother, Maud, was one of the most famous magazine illustrators of her day. And when he was a kid, she used him as a model, which he didn't care for much when he got older, like baby Bogart. But he
was pretty cold house, though, wasn't it, emotionally?
He wanted for nothing. And he went to, sort of private schools, which he got kicked out of. But he rebelled against it all. It was too neat for him. And after he got kicked out of school when he was about 17 or 18, he joined the US Navy. To get away from it all. The start of a long love affair with the sea.
Now, he started, because we see at the end how
his
he does.
Boat, yeah, Santana, yeah,
yeah, he absolutely yeah. does. So when he goes into acting, it's the theatre he goes to first, and it's New York.
Yeah.
And what kind of roles does he get there?
Really bad ones. He always recalled this one where he had to walk on the stage and say, "Tennis, anyone?" He basically was a kind of a sort of upper class twit and stooge and sort of minor figure in loads of plays. And because he didn't look like, Rudolph Valentino or somebody, he wasn't getting leading roles. But several marriages kind of helped him establish himself. And the good thing about Catherine Ferguson's film is that it really talks about the women in his life, beginning with his spectacular sounding mother, who was a suffragette, civil rights activist, but maybe not the most maternal. And then his first two wives were both big Broadway stars.
This is Mary Phillips and...
Helen Menken is the first one, and then Mary Phillips. Him and Helen Menken only stayed married for a year. He did believe in marriage because he married a lot of times, but it didn't always work out. But she helped him. And then Mary Phillips really helped him because he started to get larger roles. And also to escape the stereotypes that he'd been stuck in.
So then his third wife I found fascinating. Yeah. This is Mayo Metho.
Yeah.
And he goes to Hollywood. He meets her. She is at the top of her career. She's quite Jean Harlow-esque. Yeah. She's a femme fatale.
Mae West type as well, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But she gets jammed up against the Hays Code, which really stops her career.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Hays Code, because things had been quite lax in Hollywood. And in fact, I think it was Mary Phillips, his second wife, was in a Broadway play about lesbian lovers. So things were, you know, quite relaxed in the 20s. And then the Hays Code came in, courtesy of a couple of overzealous Irish-Americans, unfortunately. And then Hollywood was suddenly cleaned up, and so Mayo Metho's career, which had been based on this kind of very bawdy, as you say, Mae West type persona, began to hit the skids. Just when she met Bogart, he was kind of on the down escalator, as somebody says, she was on the down escalator and he was on the way up, which must have been very difficult for her.
Okay, let's hear a clip of that, which has some clips of Mayo Metho's film career with Humphrey Bogart.
She grew older, whereas for Bogart it was all right to grow older.
I don't really look old, do I? Well, what does he expect a girl to look like at 6 a.m. after dragging a lot of heavyweight shoe salesmen around the dance floor all night? Like a debutante?
You knew the deceased Betty Stauber?
Yes, sir.
You please speak a little louder so the jury can hear you?
Yes, sir.
What kind of a girl would you say she was?
She was the sweetest kid you ever saw.
They boozed a great deal, and they fought a great deal, and asked him why he enjoyed fighting with her so much, and he said because the making up was so pleasant.
I don't want to fight with you tonight. You're beautiful.
That does those use of the clips and the narrative does show Catherine Ferguson's approach, a bit like she did in the Sinead O'Connor documentary, Nothing Compares, where we almost saw Sinead O'Connor's story from her own point of view.
Yeah,
she does this very much with Humphrey Bogart as well.
She does, and there's a kind of voiceover, somebody's impersonating him reasonably well, and it's his own words. So that's kind of interesting, because you get to hear from him, you get to hear from his son briefly, you get to hear from some of the, in retrospect, from some of the people who knew him. And it does give a fuller picture that him and Mayo were known in the Hollywood tabloids as the battling Bogarts, because they used to go mad for each other. And in a way, he had been quite an inhibited actor. And I think she released it. People certainly thought so. Louise Brooks, who was a friend of theirs, certainly thought so. Things got pretty serious between them when they fought. Like, she was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia subsequently, but I think she stabbed him, or she shot at him, she stabbed him, and they kept going back to each other. And in fact, he talked about during the making of Casablanca, which we heard at the start, he would go home and he said she'd be lying in wait for him. But eventually all that came to a halt when he met Lauren Bacall.
Now, you talked about all the hood parts he got, these kind of, you know, he was just a brute in an awful lot of the films.
Yes.
Who recognised then that he could do a lot more?
Well, Leslie Howard gave him his first break, because they starred in a play called The Petrified Forest. And when Leslie Howard was asked to do a film in Hollywood, he insisted that Bogart be part of that. That was his initial break. And then John Huston worked on a film with him, and he saw how good he was. High Sierra was that film in which he played another gangster, but a more nuanced gangster, a gangster with much more complexity. After that, John Huston got to direct his first film. That was The Maltese Falcon, and he insisted on Bogart starring in that.
Now, of course, you mentioned Lauren Bacall there, and they would have met on when she was, like, she had been a model, then she had kind of...
Betty Persky.
Yes, yeah. Not the greatest drama career or film career.
No, a couple of plays was all she'd done when they met on the set of To Have and Have Not.
But then it was magic. So let's listen to Lauren Bacall talking about Bogart.
He awakened in me, obviously, something that had never been awakened before, and something that I really needed. And I needed someone to really care about me. And I guess I needed a man to care about me. And he was the most caring man that I've ever known. And it just happened that suddenly I just had to be with him all the time.
We started shooting The Big Sleep on October 10th, 1944. He told me that the last few weeks had been the most difficult of his life. Mayo said she'd stopped drinking. He had to give her a chance. After about 2 weeks of shooting, the phone rang late one night. He'd had a fight with Mayo, of course. She'd been drinking when he got back from the studio, and things went from bad to worse. About 3 weeks into the picture, Bogey left home and checked into the Beverly Hills Hotel.
I couldn't go on with the battles we'd had. I wanted a new life.
What's wrong with you?
Nothing you can't fix.
There, Bacall and Bogart at the end of that clip from the new documentary directed by Catherine Ferguson. We get the power of that relationship, but they were quite party people as well, weren't they?
They certainly were. He was not that sociable, actually, and she was. Well, she was younger, and she was much more sociable, and she encouraged him into what became the sort of the loose and famous drinking affiliation, the Rat Pack, with Frank Sinatra. He loved Frank Sinatra and Angie Dickinson and David Niven and all these other people. And he began to go out more. His boat became the focus of all these kind of parties. And yeah, they lived the high life. Sometimes, if Stephen, the son, is to be believed, at the expense of their children, because I mean, he was quite old when he had the children. He said at one point, "I didn't really understand them, and they didn't really understand me." Stephen felt that had he lived to be older, he would have been a better parent. But I think sometimes the kids got left behind in all the glamour. Kids
literally left behind when they both went to Africa, yeah, when he was shooting the African Queen.
Yeah, you couldn't make that up. I didn't know that story before. He was going to shoot the African Queen with Houston in Africa with Katharine Hepburn, which was going to be crazy. And Lauren Bacall decided to go with them. And they were to leave the kids with the grandparents. But on the tarmac after they took off, his nanny died with Stephen in his arms. And she was told about this and she decided not to come back, which we would all be quite judgy about now. But I suppose they were off having a good time.
I suppose so. And I suppose they had parents or grandparents.
They had grandparents.
Grandparents. But he died, I mean, 57, at the height of his career, died.
Yeah, he did.
And there's a wonderful clip which Catherine Hepburn talks. She talks about their last visit to see him.
Spencer Tracy.
Spencer Tracy, yeah. And Catherine Hepburn. Yeah. And we play that. It's Bogart's death.
Spencer and I went to the house. We talked for a while, and Bogey was entertaining, as always. And he was sitting in a chair in his bedroom, sitting in a wheelchair. And then we got up to go so as not to exhaust him. And I kissed him goodbye, walked over to the door, and Spencer walked over and patted his shoulder and said, "We're on our way." And Bogey reached up with his hand, patted Spencer's hand, looked at him, and said, "Goodbye, Spence."
That's Bogart, Life Comes in Flashes. I think you'd recommend it, Paul.
Oh, it's fascinating. For anybody interested in that era and him and her, it's just fascinating.
Well, thank you so much to Paul Whittington. Bogart, Life Comes in Flashes, directed by Catherine Ferguson, will be released digitally on Apple, I think, on December the 9th. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.